You've tuned your car, truck, or motorcycle to growl, roar, or vroom in any way louder than is necessary. When you rev your engine and treat everyone within a quarter mile to the aggressive noise you have spent time and money to broadcast, you only sound incredibly sad. It's indistinguishable from a baby screaming on an airplane or the subway, except the baby is not doing it on purpose. To further pollute the public airspace that we all share in that manner is to be a bad citizen. Please think about what you're doing. It's painful and violent. And I would ask you to consider working out your insecurities in some other way, like Dungeons and Dragons. Cedric, I'm obviously still talking to you. I could go on and on. Because of the myriad types of people represented on the roads of my neighborhood, but these ideas of neighborliness apply everywhere. In Glacier National Park, we successfully managed interactions with all sorts of folks on the trail, and I'm pleased to report that, based on my numbers, the kind of people who will hike a national park trail are much more apt to return a friendly greeting than the citizens of Greater Los Angeles. But that morning, as we came off the nature trail and headed for the falls, we crossed a sturdily built wooden footbridge that spanned the outlet stream between Two Medicine Lake and Lower Two Medicine Lake. The guidebook called it an outlet stream, but near the bridge, it seemed much more a rushing, plunging, albeit small, river. Some torrential falls of 8 or 10 feet above and below the bridge had people pulling up a seat to watch the exciting power of the cascading jade water and the deafening soundscape. For some reason, this noise was more appealing to us than the souped-up exhaust system on somebody's Camaro in Hollywood. P.S. I love motorcycles. I love Camaros. I also love the benevolent part of Christianity, but then the aggressive billboards hit me as much more similar to the loud motorcycle. What is behind that impulse to shout, exactly? Hey guys, our motorcycles are so kick-ass for maneuverability and gas mileage and just feeling the wind on our faces, but check this out. What if we make them sound fucking horrible? I mean, like, painfully loud, right? We enjoyed this assault on our ears and eyes as we communicated those classic signals of a good time when it's too loud to hear one another, grins and nods and pointing at particular details and features. Our guide, John, eventually beckoned us past the bridge, and when we could once again hear human speech, keeping the mood buoyant, he explained that drowning and water-related accidents were surprisingly the most prevalent danger in the park. The churning power exhibited that day by the relatively small stream next to us made that easy to believe. As we trekked on another half mile, we paused at a few different turnouts off the main trail, which provided alternative viewpoints from which to see the falls. For a relatively short walk, the scenic bang for our buck was quite substantial, which lent the day a pleasant gravity, as the culmination of our week was at hand. Even so, it was reminiscent of our first day at the Hidden Lake Overlook, with the feeling once again of strolling amongst bovine shoppers at a mall or theme park sightseers. When the curving trail finally brought us through a tall, dark hallway of pine trees and massive boulders out into the arena of the main event at the foot of the falls, the beefy cataract was truly magnificent in that way that a three-dimensional organic phenomenon can be. Exuding a visual magic, a version of nature's masterpiece that you can do your best to try to capture on film, in a photo or video, but the magic just never translates to seeing it in person. Like so many clouds or snowstorms at which I had gaped, This waterfall scenario was also being enhanced by the winds blowing a spray of rain-like droplets off the water at the top of the cliff so that everything appeared to wetly sparkle. As we stepped closer to the action and spun slowly around, shavings of rainbow also came and went in the mist, upping the sensation of magic even more. Running Eagle Falls has also been called Trick Falls, due to the peculiar fact that the water can plummet from 40 feet high during the spring runoff when the volume is high, or else from only 20 feet up when the volume is lower and the water up top flows into a sinkhole and thus out a lower exit. So you could see the falls at the normal height of 20 feet, then come back in the spring to marvel that they had somehow doubled in height, hence Trick Falls. I picked this tidbit up from one of those informational plaques near the trailhead, which is also where I first took on board the name of the aforementioned Running Eagle, and had my interest piqued by a Blackfeet woman so notoriously dominant that she had a water plummet named after her. Meanwhile, Jeff and George and I were blissing out in the bright sun below the waterfall, chilly in the heavy mist that rained upon us. It was a wonderful sensation, only slightly hampered by the fact that the next group of people were waiting to come stand in the plumb middle spot where we were now standing, just like we had waited our turn before this. There were no instructions posted, nor park rangers present keeping the peace, just us hikers slash cheeseburger enthusiasts maintaining our own space for what we all deemed to be a polite enough length of time. As our replacements slowly encroached upon us, we gently commandeered one of them to take a picture of us. We look very at peace, we three, with a self-satisfaction representing all the victories and defeats in a week well-lived, capped off by this moment right now, lit by a glorious afternoon sun. We had done well in our lives, against all odds, and this trip was evidence of that. The odds I refer to would be our propensity as middle-aged, straight, white guys to somehow hobble or ultimately destroy ourselves under the influence of the enormous privilege we lived with. We had earned enough income to spend a week in Glacier National Park and pay a high-quality guide to make certain that our diversions would be safe and comfortable and therefore as pleasurable as possible. People don't realize how hard it can be to accomplish the simplest of responsible tasks when there is so much insobriety, infidelity, and insider trading being seductively slapped up one side of our heads and down the other. But for the three of us this time, we did it. The cherry atop the cake of our trip was our final dinner, where we took a moment to review some of the week's highlight reel. With heavy reluctance, Jeff reminded us that mere days ago, we had been in the throes of a terrifying maelstrom of river water while rafting. As he told it, we were being churned and jostled to the point where I couldn't tell if I was facing up or down. We were taking on lots of water. I was freezing. It looked like night was about to fall, dark clouds rolling in. And out of the corner of my eye, I caught this glint of beveled glass. Are those my glasses? It couldn't be. My glasses are still on my face. Yes, George replied, resisting a smile. It was fraught, and you should also remember that I'm pretty much legally blind. So those must be George's glasses, Jeff continued. They're about to go in the drink, straight down to Davy Jones's locker. So with all my might, I lunged forward and scooped the glasses out. At the same time, I kept rowing, because our taskmaster of a boat captain was screaming at me to keep rowing, and I knew it was a matter of life and death, because if I stopped rowing, our side of the boat would be powerless. I got the glasses, but I wasn't out of danger yet. They slipped out of my hands just a little bit, this is God's truth, and I saw them just going over the curve of the boat into the water, so I lunged even farther forward, stretching farther than I'd ever stretched before in my life, farther than you've probably seen anyone ever stretch. We all laughed, but soon the conversation turned more serious, or sappy, as my buddies down at the gravel pit would say. Jeff, putting his tales of derring do aside, finally said, "Nick, thank you for putting this together. I was scared to take this trip. Turns out I was right to be a little scared, but I'm better now." "Thank you guys for coming," I replied. It was exactly what I'd dreamed of, but fully twice as good. It was George's turn to think about the bigger picture. "I'm coming away kind of jazzed about America. The countryside, of course. But weren't the people on the trail nice?" I agreed. That's why I could leave my phone on a rock to shoot an hour-long time lapse. Hikers aren't going to steal my phone. If they notice it, they'll just look at it and see that it's there on purpose. George nodded. "But sometimes it's a little more complicated. I'm sure some of the people we passed on the trail were Trump supporters, but they were really nice." Jeff said, "There are a lot of people just not participating in all the bullshit, one way or another. I mean, unfortunately, I think a lot of them don't vote." George, "Being nice is different than being..." Jeff, "Good. Or maybe being nice is the same as being good, but not everyone has been taught to be good in the abstract. They can be good directly, and that's very, very important, but that's the trick of it. Liberals are constantly trying to get people to be good in the abstract. Be good to people you don't know, even if you don't know what their lives are like. To be good to people you don't care about," he said. At the risk of opening a theological can of worms here, just as I'm trying to tie a nice bow on part one of the book, I do believe that the behavior Jeff was suggesting was simply one of the cornerstones of Christian thought. Voicing it thus, to my way of thinking, only goes to show how far the ideology of our country's so-called conservatives has strayed from the values upon which their beliefs were supposedly founded. It's almost as though those values were never sincerely revered in the first place. John Fugelsang put it quite succinctly when he said, "The only way you can follow both Trump and Jesus is if you've never read either of their books." As for George and Jeff and me, this conversation was exactly the kind of content I was after. Together with John's guidance and expertise, we had mostly enjoyed a deep dive into how American citizens might use the lands that our government has set aside for preservation. We three middle-aged white guys, ever aware of our privilege, had taken pretty full advantage of the recreation available in the glorious acreage that some other white guys had set aside for just that purpose. With regard to Wendell Berry's challenge, I believe that we made a substantial beginning. On the spectrum of land use, we fulsomely inhabited the John Muir end, getting ourselves out into nature and truly reveling in her glory. Our country still has a long way to go to reconcile these magnificent parks with the way in which they were acquired, but that said, I am extremely grateful for the great idea that they remain. Hey, what if we were to use the wealth of the parks themselves to make reparations to the indigenous tribes from whom they were brutally torn? Could that be an even greater idea? In any case, it was time for me to turn my investigation toward the other end of the land use spectrum and poke my nose into what Wendell was getting at when he pointed me toward Aldo Leopold. Knowing Wendell, I suspected that answer would be somewhat agrarian, having to do with the cultivation of land, which would be great because it is a subject I have long adored. Little could I have known, however, to what strange new places this quest would lead me, or that I was about to make another amazing new friend. Part 2. Chapter 8. All roads lead to the farm. I know what you're thinking. Great balls of fire, when are you going to spill some of that showbiz tea you've been hoarding in your cupboard, buddy? Well, first of all, thank you for patiently wading through all of that touchy-feely badger talk in Part 1 to get to your sizzling reward right off the bat here in Part 2. That's right, loves. It's Rob Lowe Hot Goss. Now, hold up a second. It seems rather unlikely, but maybe there are some of you who have come to be listeners of mine without having crossed paths with any of my several jobs as an American actor on screens of all sizes and some stages as well. Could it be possible that you only signed up for this mildly challenging listening experience because you have seen my woodworking and perhaps even came down on the side of approval? If so, then please bear with me briefly as I seek to satiate the low palates of the remainder of my dozens of fans, citizens who, like myself, occasionally, even frequently, consume recorded play-acting stories like television and cinematic films. As is my constant aspiration, let us decide not to judge one another for whatsoever proclivities we tend to enjoy when it comes to tickling our free time selves. Now, here's the scuttlebutt. When I first began dating my wife in the year 2000, or more accurately, when my wife began tolerating me on a regular medium to heavy schedule, we each rattled off a litany common to romantically involved thespians. You talk through your past acting jobs of note / lovemaking partners to deduce whether you share any past allies or enemies, or if there are any historical tryst participants who need to be avoided going forward, as they might represent a landmine of jealousy or resentment. It's really for the safety of everybody involved. This is how I came to be gently informed that Megan had engaged in a muscular French kissing scene with Rob Lowe in the 1986 film About Last Night. Mind you, this bomb was dropped on me several years before I would meet the same Mr. Lowe on the set of the comedy program Parks and Recreation. When she told me about it, he was just a major heartthrob from films of my youth. Perhaps the major heartthrob, or second only to Patrick Swayze. Thankfully, I've always been pretty good at letting this sort of information roll off my back. Whenever I've felt a twinge of jealousy in the past, I've simply examined my relationship and doubled down on my partner's happiness and satisfaction. If I give her no reason to look elsewhere, then I need not worry about her straying. If, however, she were to stray despite my sincere attentions, then it would mean it wasn't meant to be in the first place. All was well as we embarked upon the first few years of our courtship and then our marriage, until one fateful day when I was putting on a suit for a banquet that we were attending that evening. We were at a hotel in New York, and the TV was just randomly on in the next room. As I began knotting my tie, I suddenly recognized Megan's voice coming from the television, so I rushed in just in time to see her in about 30 pounds of 80s hair, lip-wrestling Rob Lowe, like it was an Olympic event in that aforementioned film. Such is the degree of my wife's acting skills, and it must be said, the magnitude of Rob Lowe's allure, that this vision shook me from my usual firm foundation. I raised my voice to the next room in a plaintive query. Honey, do you love Rob Lowe? Well, of course not. That unnerving, unholy even, scene had been filmed almost 20 years earlier, and Megan had been through all kinds of relationships and substantial life changes since that day in a movie when she had so clearly been in love with him. I took a deep breath and regained my usually plumb disposition, treating all hardships with the mellowest vibes I could muster, but I never quite got back to perfectly straight. Something about Megan's kissing Rob Lowe kept me just a degree or so off balance whenever it crossed my mind, which I'm afraid to say was often. Life continued for us in a relatively blissful progression all the way right up until 2010 or so, when, of all the crazy coincidences, that dark prince of the cheekbones, Rob Lowe, ended up on Parks and Recreation, a quality program upon which I already played a role. It was a very intoxicating time, with firecrackers banging off right and left all about the place, and adding a powerfully successful Hollywood person like Rob, who was upon his arrival immediately dubbed Rolo by Amy Poehler and Rashida Jones, felt significant. I do my best to mind my manners in general, but often, when things start going great and moving fast, I feel more susceptible to screwing things up. Everywhere I turned, wonderful things were happening, mainly thanks to the amazing writers and producers of that program. Those many of us along for the ride just did our best to hang on for dear life and scarf down all the bacon that life kept setting in front of me, I mean us. The carousel ride had been accelerating from Parks Season 2 into Season 3, faster and faster, round and around, until halfway through that season came an episode called Eagleton, during which Rob Lowe's character, Chris Traeger, discovers that it's my character Ron Swanson's birthday, and grabs me by the face and gives me a big kiss on the mouth. I've never been to Burning Man, but from what I've been given to understand, getting a smooch plastered on my pie hole by that world champion lover made my sensory perceptions explode in veritable ejaculations of light, sound, yea, and fury too, that I would deem to be commensurate with that high desert art festival freakout. It was Burning Man turned up to 11 inside my soul and my brain and my breadbasket. The film crew led me to a chair where I had to sit and breathe deeply like a spent mule as I waited for the tears to cease their flowing and the hallucinations to subside. And mind you, I was being paid handsomely for this wet and wanton act of mouth sex. When I could see shapes again, our compassionate PA Lorenzo led me to the craft services table, where I chugged a full gallon of cran raspberry and made a large onion sandwich to wash the memory of that man from my kisser and my conscience. Now that I think about it, given some slight allowances for time and space, you could technically say that Rolo, Megan, and myself had a threesome. Given the state of his dance card across the decades, I'm sure we're only one three-way of dozens, but I'm happy to report that our marriage survived this unexpected dalliance, and I never worried about Megan straying again. The tit-for-tat tally had been made even. Now that I have undoubtedly satisfied your craven hunger for loose talk, let's veer back toward the object of this tome as I launch us into part two. There is some crossover appeal here because it's my work as an actor that indirectly led me to the remote corner of the world of agriculture I'm about to unwrap for you. You're also about to witness my falling head over heels, or ass over teacup, as he might say, for another fellow who may not be the lady killer Rob Lowe is, but I have seen ladies by the score come running at him like he was all for the Beatles and Harry Styles to boot. The braying, adoring females were none of them wearing knickers either, because they just happened to be his happy ewes, lady sheep for the uninitiated. This particular obsession started back in 2017. My involvement on social media tends to be spotty, and I generally find that I'm happier off of it, then as well as now. That said, I do pop onto Twitter and Instagram to see a few people who make me laugh, and or to glean the state of the world from a selection of brains that I've curated to translate the news of the day for me. Here's what the evil people are lying about, and here is why lying is still very bad. I look at some chair makers and boat builders and a barbecue chef. I try to cull just the good bits from my feed and then jump out before I run into the rampant shitstorm of negativity that can flare up in any quarter. It was around that time in 2017 that I became glued to the feeds of James Rebanks and his wife Helen, a couple of fell shepherds, as they are known, for the mountainous hills or fells that their sheep inhabit in England's Lake District for part of each year. I could already see that the two of them did an amazing job of balancing a progressive farm life, living off-grid with four kids, now ages 3 to 15, growing and cooking a lot of their own meal ingredients, then masterfully sharing the whole circus with their following via social media. Oh, and James is also now a massively best-selling author of a few books, including The Shepherd's Life, and English Pastoral, called Pastoral Song in the U.S. Their farm was a place that I had come to know well via my online browsing, as though regularly viewing it through some sort of science fiction portal. Normally, such a two-dimensional observational practice would be visually pleasing but cold, and a bit lifeless otherwise. James and Helen, however, did such a replete job of keeping their followers involved in the farming day to day that it sometimes felt like I was there with them. They're reporting on the state of the sheep herds or the state of the land itself, and working with new plantings, hedgerows, streams, and pastures left me understanding the nature in their little part of England more fully than that of my own Los Angeles street. Later that year, I found myself casually chiming in on some of James's posts. I had originally been drawn to his account because of his aforementioned quality content, as well as our shared appreciation for the writing of, you guessed it, Wendell Berry, whom he often referenced in his posts. And the more I read, the more I fell for the charming personal stories about James's family and his flock of Herdwick sheep, set on the historic fells in the far northwest corner of the country, but also his overview of topics like the rewilding of our planet's developed agricultural spaces, or the food and farming policies of the British government as well as those of the United States. Before long, James dropped me a DM, dad mandate, or I guess he slid into my DMs. That sounds maybe too sexy for a couple of aspiring barn builders, regardless of our love of hip-hop dance and crunking. Let's just say he got in touch to say, if you're ever in our neck of the woods, do come see the farm. Well, that was mighty friendly, and I replied, sure thing. You never know when I might get to your neck of the woods. But after immediately looking up his location, I saw that it was not convenient to London nor Glasgow, which meant that it wasn't going to be an easy flyby while I was out touring with a comedy show. Still, you never do know. My calendar, with each passing year, yielded more and more surprising delights as I continued to book gigs as a film and TV actor and as a touring humorist. Various jobs had seen me working in recent years in such far-flung locales as New Zealand, South Africa, the remote jungles of darkest Canada, Tasmania, and the rest of Australia, plus all over the British Isles and United States. So, sure enough, just a few months after James invited me to the farm in early 2018, I landed a terrifically plum job on a science fiction series called Devs for a sublime British filmmaker named Alex Garland that would bring me geographically quite close to the Rebanks farm. I'm a pretty down-to-earth thinker, mainly because I don't have a lot of high right-brain capacity, but even though I don't often think on a creative, new-age plane, that doesn't mean I discount it, especially when things like this occur. You can call it mojo, or kismet, or serendipity, or whatever you like. Just don't call me late for dinner. But seriously, folks, I wanted to go meet a shepherd, and I wanted it real bad. And it inexplicably and beautifully was about to happen. This will get a tad serpentine, but trust me, it all comes back to a more open-minded version of how we view nature. Let me back up to getting this acting job. After several years of extreme good fortune and landing gigs, I had taken a pause on accepting new work, stepping off the hamster wheel, if you will, to nibble some cheese and watch the world go by. This was purely a gut decision, fueled by a suspicion that things in my life might get more interesting if I considered other goals than those offered by pure capitalism. Taking the seemingly less lucrative path has, somewhat surprisingly, worked well for me so far. Choosing to pursue a career in live theater, for example, is never a good idea if one is seeking a pile of wealth. But it's where I met my wife, inarguably the richest gold strike a prospector panning for life value could hope to seek. Likewise, starting a fine woodworking shop would be extremely inadvisable as a financial investment, but the dividends my shop has paid me in peace of mind, quality handcrafting, and pub avoidance are priceless. Therefore, by passing on some more conventional acting jobs, I had cleared some daylight on my calendar. Or perhaps more on theme, it was like I had harvested all of the produce and pulled all the weeds in my garden, then left the fecund soil simply available to nature's whim. Rather than letting Jesus take the wheel, I let Mother Nature take the trowel. And so she did. Before too long, she had cultivated my life with some completely unexpected new bounty. And I was now working with a filmmaker I greatly admired, not to mention a top-drawer cast and crew of collaborators. The program would shoot in and around Santa Cruz, California, for the first half of the six-month schedule, depicting nearby Silicon Valley, where the show was set. Once our shooting at all of the American locations was completed, we would move to sound stages in London and Manchester, England, a hard-working city that happened to be a 90-minute train ride south of James Rebanks and his idyllic farm. I mean, come on. Santa Cruz, where we began filming in late 2018, was in many ways the epitome of a California beach town, including an amusement park on the pier, but with a little extra funk. The sexy Brat Pack vampire film The Lost Boys was shot there in the 80s, which is a testament not only to the Hollywood good looks of the community, but also to an easily accessed, mysterious dark side. Dramatic cliffs and beaches are framed by towering redwood forests, undulating up and down the mountainous topography. Just outside town is a gravitational anomaly known as the mystery spot, where your perceptions of the laws of physics and gravity will be questioned. I even stayed at a hotel named The Paradox. Maybe it's because Santa Cruz is far from any major highways, so it's lacking any of the superficial attempts at freshness that one sees next to any given freeway off-ramp these days, the gaudy sparkles of consumerism. Whatever the reason, I found the town to have a really groovy vibe, like it never fully made it out of the 70s. I reveled in my time shooting scenes at the University of California, Santa Cruz, a cluster of modern concrete and glass structures from the mid-60s nestled into the redwood forest on the hillsides above the town. During my breaks, I would run along the ocean or ride a rented mountain bike on the miles of paths through the many neighboring parks. The campus was dotted with deer, docilely munching on greenery as they strolled about. The farmers' markets in town and the restaurants were very hooked into the local agriculture and seafood situations as well, which always gives me a much more substantial sense of getting to commune with the local occupants. I found myself at the Live Oak Market investigating some Michoacan fare I had heard about from Eddie, one of our transpo drivers. And the kind woman who served me my tacos then recommended a roadside shop in the nearby mountains with a butcher, famous for his locally sourced sausages, and so on. In one section of the college, we shot a scene in which another actor and myself cross a wooden trestle bridge away from the campus, uphill to the deeper redwoods, and eventually emerge in a clearing where my character has built a huge research facility named Devs. Things would eventually get pretty sci-fi in that futuristic building, where in the story we had developed a quantum computer that allowed us to more fully investigate the quantum many-worlds theories, like seeing into other dimensions or alternate realities kind of stuff. Knowing that we would later shoot the interior of this magical building in England made the scenes in Santa Cruz extra fun, approaching the doorway as opening onto something great that we hadn't yet countenanced, but could be pretty certain would be astonishing. Adding to the uncanny feeling of living in a fantasy quest, one of the philosopher elf kings from mere pages ago, my dear friend George Saunders, was staying in Santa Cruz as well. He and his charming wife Paula took me on a hike that ended at a Buddhist prayer stupa deep in the forest. We had a really great talk about our unlikely paths from Chicagoland laborers to successful artists, but how, even though we both had our rent or mortgage comfortably covered for the time being, we both still felt inescapably human. Still just trying to get things done right every day. We were now just lucky enough to be doing it with more clean socks in the drawer. George is one of our most exceptional living thinkers, by the way. I would say award-winning, which happens to be accurate, but I feel like that phrase has lost its luster in the same way as organic and cage-free have lost theirs. One proof of his wisdom is that he claims to be trying his best not to think. Just check out his commencement speech from Syracuse University in 2013, entitled Congratulations, by the way, now available in slender book form. It's a gentle, humorous treatise on kindness. All of this to say that I really like listening to George talk, whether he's reading his own writing in an audiobook or holding forth in one of his creative writing classes, which I've had the distinct pleasure of auditing, or just rapping about the Buddha. We were in this ideal sylvan setting, with clusters of sunlight playing leafy shadows across the stupa in the light breeze. And George spoke about the idea in Buddhism that one's thoughts are actually constructed concepts of the world. We can never comprehend all of the information in any given circumstance, so the brain creates little false constructed scale models to allow us to function, but they're all incorrect. Because of all the information we're missing, the more complex and substantial your imagined scale models become, the more diluted you actually grow. Thus, when we step into nature and use our senses to try to take on board all the information we can, we necessarily fail every time, especially if we do engage in too much thinking, Because what God is saying to us in the scope of her creation is this. Here is a glimpse of what I, God, can think, but you, human, can never remotely comprehend it. So don't think too much. This was a pleasurable ladleful of meditative notions in any case, but it was made extra savory in the knowledge that it was all part of the synchronicity of my Alex Garland dream, brought effectively to bear by my nibbling of some cheese. Then George took me down the road to grab lunch at his favorite place, and wouldn't you know it, it was the famous butcher sausage shop. I had the bratwurst, and it was amazing. Santa Cruz had clearly enchanted me, and I would have been much more reluctant to leave had it not been for the rest of our filming awaiting us in London and Manchester in late 2018. The cast and crew all went to our respective homes for the Thanksgiving holiday, which I believe is referred to in England as late November. Then we reconvened in London for some chilly December work. One of the first nights I shot there took place a couple hours southwest of the Big Smoke, in a botanic garden that actually housed an entire hillside of redwood trees. The enormous conifers, exclusively indigenous to the coast of Northern California and Oregon, had been brought back to England and transplanted about 150 years earlier by a British botanist, and they had grown into a stately grove that perfectly mirrored the woods in Santa Cruz. For various reasons, it made sense to split up the shoot this way, and here I offer to you the way one of my favorite aspects of filmmaking magic works. So in the first episode of Devs, we see my character, Forrest, leading the character Sergei off campus and across a wooden trestle bridge into the redwoods. We then cut to the English forest as we see Sergei and me, Forrest, chatting while they stroll through the woods en route to the Devs Research Building. Cut back to the golden-grassed clearing in Santa Cruz, where Sergei and me, Forrest, come into view of the astonishing Devs Building. My character describes to him the groundbreaking ingenuity with which he designed and built the place as they slowly approach the entrance portal. As they step through the square opening into a long antechamber/hallway, we then cut to the soundstage in Manchester, where the interior of the Devs Building had been crafted. Finally, once inside the hallway, the two characters are able to look back out through the portal and see a reconstructed view of the autumnal Santa Cruz field with redwood trees in the background. I'm pretty simple-minded to begin with, but at that moment, I really was transported. Standing inside the gorgeous set piece that was the Devs Building interior, having been present for each of the discrete locations filmed, so as to seamlessly become this dramatic walking sequence, and looking out the set door at the manufactured, fading California sunlight in a Manchester soundstage, made me tear up. It struck me as an interesting parallel to the subject matter of the Devs show itself, part of which was concerned with the effect on our lives and choices of being able to view through a portal other versions of our own reality. Now, cut to me, on my first extended free weekend in Manchester, hopping on a train for 90 minutes to go see the Rebanks Farm. A place, an entire flesh-and-blood reality that I had only theretofore glimpsed through the portal of my iPhone screen, or even more tenuously, through the portal of my imagination when I read James's first book, The Shepherd's Life. I mean, what would any normal Joe do with a handful of days to kill in England, just an hour east of Liverpool, birth town of the Beatles? Go snap some selfies on Penny Lane? Skip about in a radical socialist reverie in search of the red gatepost in Woolton? Or go rogue, ferry across the Mersey, and seek alleyways where Frankie Goes to Hollywood might have enjoyed a wee slash? Hell no, mate. I was hauling my ass to Cumbria to see some sheep. Chapter 9. Racy Gill. I have not yet had the giggle-tastic pleasure of visiting the Shire set from The Lord of the Rings in Wellington, New Zealand, nor the Kiwi's illustrious Weta Workshop, where so many of the denizens of Peter Jackson's and Tolkien's Middle-earth were molded, sculpted, or sewn, nor have I ever set foot in Hogwarts or Narnia. But I have visited these fantastic locales so often in my mind and on my screen that I feel like I have been there. So when James picked me up at the train station on a freezing cold January morning in 2019 and drove me 20 minutes to Racy Gill Farm, it felt something like I was going to visit the hometown of Galadriel, Tumnus, or Hagrid. The Rebanks homestead, set on its rolling hillside adorned with comely sheep all around, was finally going to appear before my own eyes instead of on the screen of my smartphone or imagined through the pages of James's books. I hadn't stopped grinning since the moment I stepped into the station and James and I shook hands. Part of the reason for my glee was simply the effect that his truck had on me. He drove what in the States would be considered a pretty small SUV. There was a sleeping one-year-old in a car seat, and it was filthy. It told the story with immediacy that six people used this vehicle to assist them in their labors as they husbanded sheep and a few cows and many laying hens, and three of them attended school as well and rode horses and went down to the lake for fun on the water, all while sometimes scarfing down a biscuit, cookie, or other form of snack or lunch. It reminded me of visiting the house of a new friend that happened to exhibit the chaos resulting from parenthood and the bustle of work and school, compelling the friend to apologize for the mess. To this, I always reply with an admonition, "Are you crazy? This scene clearly has written all over it that you are living. This speaks of health and vigor. If this place was impeccably spotless and resembled the cover of a design magazine, then I'd be worried about you." James's truck was the same. It wasn't the dirty vehicle of the lazy or the slovenly. It bore the mud and crumbs and the one small orphaned sock of people who are getting shit done. We pulled up to the house, which was a former stone barn that James and Helen had converted into a ridiculously charming family home, perpetuating the storybook quality of the experience thus far. After meeting Helen and handing off a now awake and hollering young Tom to her, James said to me, "You want to mend a stacked stone wall?" Of course, I said, "You bet your sweet ex-rugby playing ass I do," as he tossed me a light jacket and briskly strode out into the wet, shin-deep grass on the not-half-steep hillside, accelerating his pace as he turned up the incline. "This is great!" he shouted as he began to point out different features of the farm, stone walls and hedgerows and tree plantings. "Mind the beck!" A beck is a small stream in the parlance of Cumbria, and this one took all I had to leap successfully across it. "Jesus," I thought, still grinning. I did not think that today would be the day I perish, and death by shepherd, no less. In all my years, I have known a lot of impressive workers, but I have never seen anyone leap to their work like James bounded up that hillside. The salient point, one that I'd gathered watching from afar and now saw in person, is this. It's not that he loves the actual act of building stone walls or splitting firewood or checking sheep's hooves for infection. The reason he appears to hop to each and every task is because he loves farming. And these are the menial tasks that comprise farming. The more of them he gets done and done right, the healthier his farm becomes, and the more he and his family and their animals and every bit of his farm prosper. And that is what he loves. We arrived at the section of stone wall that had been knocked half down by the Herdwick sheep, which I have to say was no small feat. According to James, once they have grazed a pasture to the point they feel is sufficient, it sometimes occurs to them that there must be better, newer grass on the other side of a given wall. They eyeball the aged expanse of wall to discern a weak spot, then begin to rear up and knock at the wall, slowly beating the heavy stones out of alignment until they actually impel them to tumble away into the neighboring paddock, leaving a U-shaped breach through which they can jump. The youngest of these walls is 150 years old, but some of them date back many centuries. And the English countryside is just lousy with thousands of miles of them, all in various states of repair and disrepair, thanks to both time and the sheep. James sent me to the other side of the wall so that we could work together from either side to repair the void, and so that my rookie stacking wouldn't be visible from the house. He explained the system by which the carefully selected blue slate stones had been hand-shaped decades earlier to fit together puzzle-like without mortar, complete with through stones tying the wall's thickness together. From about 3 feet at the base, tapering up to a foot and a half thick at the capstones, larger, heavier, attractive stones to top off the neat stack and hold down the assembly beneath. If we wanted the repaired section to appear indiscernible from the rest of the standing wall, it was imperative to find and realign the weathered, moss-covered facets of the stones that had been facing outward and restore them to that original orientation. As you may have surmised, this work was not easy, especially at a temperature of 38 degrees. Oh, and a freezing drizzle had begun to blow, with me in only an unlined springtime jacket. But I couldn't have been happier. I know of no better way to make a friend than to pitch in on hard work together, and the shittier the conditions, the faster the friendship forms. My stacking required a decent amount of correction from James, but we made good progress despite it. The setting could not have been more conducive to talking about our dads, who taught us the value of hard work and perseverance and pride in craftsmanship, and their dads before them, and of course our mums as well. James went on to describe the many generations of his family who had shepherded in these very hills before him, and I wondered which of them had touched these stones before me, and whether the sharp stone edges had hurt their hands as well. Jesus, it was cold. I also thought about the fact that we weren't wearing gloves. Testing the fit and placement of each peculiarly shaped brick of stone required the full complement of hand, wrist, arm, and shoulder capabilities, prying, nudging, shoving, twisting, punching, and so forth. Even in warm weather, stacking these stones would have qualified as glove work for most of the crews on which I had labored. Crews that were hardly wimpy, I might add, consisting of hardy nailers and shovel jockeys all. Manchester had given a hint of this as well, displaying a northerner's obstinacy in her citizens' ambivalence to the elements, with young revelers out in the freezing cold with no outerwear. The young ladies outside the pub smoking in miniskirts and laughing about it. In any case, this was my audition for the role of person worthy of farming for James, so I was going to be damned if I was going to squeak about my hands or anything else. Some call this quality hardy, game, or dependable, but most call it stupid. James looked at my last 8 stones, smiled kindly, and instructed me to pull them off and start again. No room for politeness in this work, the result of which he hoped would last for decades more. As my education continued, we bonded over our love of books in general, but especially the agrarian ilk of Wendell Berry and Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. And how funny it was that love had brought me all the way to this wintry Cumbrian pasture to perform hard, wet, cold labor and consider it a good time. Jobs like this, he said, were perfectly meditative, giving him a window of opportunity to work out notions and through lines he would incorporate into his writing. I told him that was the equivalent of sanding in the woodshop, the repetitive chore that allowed part of one's mind to work on creative construction. I could not have been more powerfully chuffed at how this was going down. We were engaged in my favorite pursuit, making something with our hands, and we were doing it with a method that people had been employing for millennia. Many, many generations ago, the locals had determined that the animals best suited to the climate and the terrain were sheep, in a handful of specific, sturdy variations. By merely tending the sheep, keeping them safe, and occasionally feeding them when the winter snows cut them off from any forage whatsoever, the shepherd families were able to raise wool and meat while having a very minimal impact on their environment. When they decided they wanted to relegate their flock's movements to a certain area, but they didn't want to engage in the use of electric fencing, mainly because they didn't want to truck with the fossil fuel corporations, and also because electricity wouldn't be invented for hundreds of years, the shepherds simply gathered up the free stones that were available on and around their land, knocked them into practical shapes with a bit of hammer and a bit of chisel, and stacked them into a serviceable structure. This act carries a similarly heroic charisma to woodland humans, learning to chop down trees, cure them, then stack the logs into a cabin to protect themselves and their loved ones, meaning their cured meats, but also probably their children. I described to James the development of the birch bark canoe by the indigenous tribes of the Canadian North Woods, who could walk into the forest with a knife and a little fire and paddle out in an 18-foot canoe. The history of the canoe had been a favorite subject, I told him, which started when I read John McPhee's wonderful The Survival of the Bark Canoe, to which James said, "Oh, you must read his Giving Good Weight." And so we checked another box, confirming we were the kind of book nerds who could spar for hours, armed with only McPhee titles. I am a disciple of these crafts because they cannot be improved upon by modern technology. No 3D printer or factory assembly line can build a finer stone wall or log cabin or weave a basket or skin a canoe than the hands of women and men. Crafting with sustainable, organic, natural materials requires the human genius of hand-eye coordination to properly and efficiently utilize what nature provides us. This requires us to pay close attention, in perpetuity, to the landscape from which our materials are gleaned, so that its health will continue to support our own. All of these crafts, bark canoes, dry stone walls, and log cabins, have required little to no improvement in tools or techniques for centuries, a fact that made James feel connected to his forebears with an immediacy when he participated in the tradition, and I felt that way too a bit as I gave up my stone wall virginity with icicle hands. I had certainly felt it powerfully when I built my first canoes with cedar and fiberglass instead of birch bark, and paddled them, one in New York Harbor and the second on the Russian River in Northern California. Crossing the obstacle that is a body of water in any large format, in a watercraft of one's own making, because of that primal, instinctive urge to get over there to the other side, because I think there's a Taco Bell over there, has been uniting humankind with our sustenance for eons, answering the ancient call of the chalupa. The development of the canoe form, by the way, not to mention the kayak, was a great example of evolutionary thinking that crossed over cultural lines. When Europeans arrived in North America, they already had a substantial boat-building tradition, obviously, since they arrived via ocean-sailing ship. The smaller watercraft of Europe were traditionally built with a sturdier, heavier construction than the canoe, with lap-straked wooden planks on frames in the rowboats, punts, and tenders that typically populated the harbors, rivers, and lakes of yore. To their credit, the French and English quickly recognized the efficacy of the Native American canoe and switched to that design for a great deal of their travel and cargo hauling in the Hudson Bay and Great Lakes regions, thereby respecting the technology of the indigenous tribes even as they profoundly disrespected its creators. As is well argued by Bruce Pascoe in his book Dark Emu, the Europeans had a terrible track record for arriving in a new world, Australia, in the case of Dark Emu, and, as we all know, devastating the native tribes by varying methods of genocide, or at least brutal displacement. In order to treat other human souls so viciously, this behavior on our part required a certain degree of denial. This was achieved by treating the American natives or the Aboriginal tribes in Australia as less than human, vermin, really, that required extermination, so that the proper civilized humans could set up house. Pascoe succinctly points out that when the English made their reports detailing the progress of their settlements down under, they therefore had to necessarily ignore the complex civilizations of the local tribes entirely, despite their methods of surviving amicably in concert with nature that had been developed over millennia. Housing, farming, fishing, complete economies eradicated. Wiped off the face of Australia.
"Nothing to see here, Your Highness, except some random savages."
Next, of course, the English heroically shipped in herds of grazing sheep and cows, and attempted to plant their wheat and other continental grains, and then looked on stupidly as they all faltered and died in inhospitable soil, within an ecosystem that was entirely alien to the biology of their plants and animals. They exhibited all the common sense of hijacking a plane for its cargo of riches and then killing the pilots without gleaning any of their imperative knowledge. We're all in so much of a hurry, then and now, to make money that we never bother learning to land the son-of-a-bitching plane. Reprieve finally came to us pasture mates when we had completed the meticulous repair job on the wall, puzzling each stone back into our best guess at its original location. The good news was the breach was gone, entirely filled in, even though James said it was not, quote, our best work. It looked pretty damn handsome to me, albeit through the eyes of the uninitiated. The bad news was we had about 7 stones left over and no rug under which to sweep them. I guess James docked my pay per stone, because based on the $0 he gave me, I must have broken even. We went inside and got washed up for lunch. Historically, one of the most glorious sensual pleasures known to woman and man alike. The phenomenon is specific to the winter, and the colder and wetter one can become before re-entry into the cozy warmth, the more profound the payoff. By that measure, based on the light jacket and the mitts of ignominy, also known as no gloves, that I had endured all morning, I was poised to receive the full flush of paradise. It began with peeling off wet garments just inside the kitchen door to the garden patio. Rain pants, boots, and jacket were left in the mud area. I went into the powder room and ran some lukewarm water to soap up my poor paws, the soft, fragile thespians gesticulating.